One of the best things about the 21st century has been the variety of creative ways radio has evolved.
Really? That's one of the best things? It's not been the best century, then.
It's been slim. But the legacy of Marconi is in good hands with Alex Lefchik and the Midweek Drivettes. So we got that going for us.
Which is nice.
Piping down the valleys wild, piping songs of fine glee. On a cloud I noticed a child, and he, laughing, said to me, "Piper music, approximately a lamb." So I piped with merry cheer, "Piper, pipe that track once more." So I piped, he wept to listen, "Drop thy pipe, thy happy pipe, sing thy songs of happy cheer." So I sung the identical once more, while he wept with joy to pay attention. I've always wanted to actually launch a midweek drive with a little touch of William Blake, and I thought you'd actually appreciate that, Jason, in terms of
yes, indeed,
William Blake scenario. It's kind of running through my mind these days as we go from Zoom meeting to Teams meeting to Blackboard Collaborate,
yes.
All those fun things. I think, what about that happy piping pipe that's actually there? Wonderful stuff there. And as I say, we welcome you back to the midweek drive. We've also got joining us today the fabulous Graham Harper. How are you, Graham?
I'm very well, thank you very much. Yep, really good.
And because they have proven to be stalwarts of shows since we started off in all sorts of ways, Rebecca Bond, how are you today?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Excellent. A level 2 undergraduate at the University of Lincoln. Fine university there that is, currently based in Norwich. And also, not too far away from that, but also in the, I think, Suffolk area, it's Gabriella Van Genians. How are you, Gabriella?
Hi, I'm fine, thank you. It's nice to be back.
Well, there we are, you see. And it's fair to say we'll also be promoting a new podcast that you're also launching with another one of our fine histories of journalism folk in the very near future, which is called, I need a drum roll for this really, but it's called Don't Stand So Close to Me. Genius, absolutely. Graham, you've had a chance to have a quick look at Jason's fabulous sort of work, and obviously William Blake is very much close to his heart. He's got a new text that was actually out there, does all sorts of things. Any questions you'd like to put to him at this stage?
There's so much to talk about. We can talk about you and what wonderful things you've done, Jason, but whatever was it that made you fall in love with William Blake? It's not that I don't, it's just that I found it extraordinary that this is something you've really waved the flag for, or he was.
Yeah.
What was it about him that made you so excited?
It was so I was a teenager, just still about a teenager, 19 years old at university, reading a degree in English literature, and I read The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, which I'll make an assumption that most people haven't read that or heard of it. So this was a book that, a very short book, a pamphlet really, that Blake produced in 1790, a year after the French Revolution had broken out. And in it, he basically said, everything you know about everything is wrong. He announced that he was on the side of the devils as opposed to the angels. He opposed one God, one king, one priest, and basically came out as one of the first very vehement English radicals of the French Revolutionary period. And also did so in a book that, if you read it the right way, is incredibly funny. He kind of just wanders around with angels, takes devils down into hell, has conversations with them over dinner. And sort of just, in my opinion, it's one of the books that is the most incredible text for kind of turning the world upside down. And I fell in love with him at that moment and have never looked back since. So it's now, let's see, it's well over 30 years that I've been reading William Blake and sort of 25 years since I've been writing about
him. It's a cosmic droplet, Jason, a cosmic droplet in terms of time. I mean, honestly,
yes.
You know, I mean, it's just a few years less than I've been at the University of Lincoln, the University of Lincoln in Humberside, so who knows? even minor on that basis. Rebecca, let's bring your good self in, because as you're well, I did actually confess to your good self, Rebecca, that a couple of weeks ago when we were in the midst of the Midweek Drive and, of course, the wonderment of Resonance Rewind, I was running that show whilst also keeping an eye on Jason's online lecture at the time, which was great. Hey, Jason's got his dog as well. Fantastic. Yes, exactly.
Sitting on my feet.
Yes. Bring on the canine friend. Anyway, Rebecca, any questions for Jason?
Yeah, well, I love William Blake too. Last year when we first started university, we were asked in our poetry seminar if we had any poets that we liked or writers, and William Blake was actually one of the ones I brought up. And I was told it was controversial. That's something I was interested in. I don't know a great deal about the history of his work, but I know that it's culturally relevant now. But there's a lot of debates about the origins of his work. Like, is there anything you know about that? I'd love to just be educated on, you know, his background, because I love his work, but I've never looked into, you know, the history or anything.
Buy the
like
book,
that.
Rebecca. Buy the book.
Buy the book. Well,
yeah, do you know what? I will.
So I'll just hijack Alex's show for half an hour. couple of things to mention. So first of all, actually, for anybody who's interested, I'm giving a talk on the book, so Blake's Biography, at 8 o'clock this evening with the Blake Society. So there's still a chance, if you want to join in later, I'll be talking about Blake and the new biography then. So I've just completed a biography of Blake and a guide to all of his works. Blake himself can be incredibly controversial, even now. There's a considerable amount of stuff that Blake writes about that I don't agree with, that I take opposition to. One of the things, however, I particularly like about Blake is that he kind of encourages that. In one of his later works, Jerusalem, he gives a line, "I must create a system or be enslaved by another man's." And actually what Blake was doing, he wasn't looking for followers. One of the things that makes him most interesting as an artist is he didn't want people to imitate him. He wanted to do his own thing, and by doing that, wanted other people to start creating their own systems as well. And that's one thing the problem was that during his lifetime, most people looked at his work and went, what the hell's going on? And it wasn't really until much later in the 19th century and then 20th century that people started to get him, as it were. It can often seem a quite dry approach, but if you look at his way of painting, for example, he detested copying things from the real world. Now, this was a period when the main form of art was naturalism. You know, you'd go out and look at a mountain and a lake and stuff like that, and you'd paint these scenes as they appeared. Blake wanted to present everything internally, everything from his imagination. Now, in a 20th century that had cubism, surrealism, all the isms of modern art, he makes complete sense. Similarly with his writing, his later writings can be very convoluted and difficult. But in a century that saw modernism and, you know, people like T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound and Virginia Woolf, again, his style makes sense. So there are things about that Blake writes. I'm not a big fan of a lot of his ideas on gender, for example. I think he got a lot of that wrong. I think, however, politically and kind of in terms of, for want of a better word, spiritual vision, he actually was one of the most interesting writers ever. And not simply, one thing that I actually have a great admiration for Blake is he was a thinker. He was actually a philosopher as well in his work. He was attempting to actually work through very complicated notions of how we perceive the world. You know, epistemology, to give it its formal title, ontology, how things exist around us and what that meaning is, all the big questions, actually. And that's why, in a sense, he kind of comes across as a religious poet, because he's dealing with those big why are we here questions as well.
Yeah, I find him so interesting. And that's why I'd love to learn more about him, because I know that a lot of his ideas are radical. And I think that does come through in his work. And when you look at it in its, you know, historical context, I think it's really interesting. So I would definitely be attending that talk if you can send me some form of link.
Do you have to do a quick plug, Alex?
Put it out there, Jason.
If you look at the Blake Society website, it's the event that's on tonight. And it's also the link, if you use Twitter at all, @Blake2_0. He says, just checking his own profile. And that's my, Blake2_0 is pinned at the top of my Twitter feed at the moment as well. So yeah.
I'm going to say, Jason, I also take my hat off to you, Jason, because I thought, you know, I'm a kind of relatively low key Twitter user. I've got about 7,000 tweets that have actually gone up there. You're in the 20,000 plus.
Yes,
it's amazing.
Yes.
It's phenomenal. It's great.
Yes, ever so slightly.
And actually, I was just sort of thinking, in terms of the poet we actually, the poem we launched with, obviously the Lamb from Songs of Innocence, etc. Is that kind of typical of Blake's kind of poetry? Because obviously Songs of Innocence and Songs of Experience, they're kind of like two almost polar opposites in many ways.
He called them to show the contrary states of the human soul, which again, for me, is one of the things that's really interesting about Blake as a writer. If you read a lot of, for example, contemporary 18th century poets or Victorian poets, they can come across as a bit saccharine, to be honest, a bit oversweet. Blake had a very strong sense of evil, of the nature of evil, and also what's fascinated me, he had a sense of evil in himself, you know, that he was capable of rage, of anger, of real hatreds, etc., which he could then channel into his art. So that kind of that what he called experience, that underbelly of the nastiness of life, stops his lighter poetry, his poetry of innocence, coming across as too simplistic, as too sweet. However, and this for me is the bit that I think a lot of contemporaries, I mean, 20th and 21st century writers and thinkers don't get, is that actually it's the fact that Blake could also do the innocence as well. So his comments about experience was, you know, you need experience. If you don't view the world with the eyes of experience, you're a fool. But if you only view the world through the eyes of experience, you're a cynic. Go back to the comment, Rebecca, that you've made about his poetry being radical. Radical people, truly radical people, are not the naysayers, are not the people who go, well, it'll never work, it will never happen. You have to have a degree of innocence. You have to have a sense of optimism that you can actually change things. If you're completely tainted with, you know, oh, I know what the world's like, I know that everything, you know, will fail, there's no point trying in any of this. Well, of course, you're not going to succeed. So innocence without experience is folly, is stupidity, but experience without innocence is actually cynicism. It's powerless. It's useless.
As indeed I've often said, a cynic is somebody who, when they smell flowers, they look around for the coffin. But anyway.
That's exactly. Exactly.
The alpha, the omega, the beginning and the end. What a perfect way to actually launch Ash Wednesday. It's fantastic. It just adds in so many perfect ways, really. Gabrielle, you've been sitting listening to some of this material, etc., and I never actually thought that I'd actually be bringing in the notion of theories of knowledge or epistemology into a midweek drive. But then again, I never thought I'd be actually sort of launching with a piece of Blake poetry. So carry on. Gabrielle, any thoughts or questions from yourself?
I just wanted to ask, Jason, when you were researching William Blake, did you find some interesting facts about him that you didn't know beforehand?
Oh, yes. So to answer that question, I think what you probably mean is the book that's coming out now. So I'll answer that specifically. But of course, I've been researching Blake for 30 years. So I'm constantly finding out stuff I didn't know before, as it were. I'll start with one that when I first started researching Blake, that absolutely blew my mind at the time. So when I first started researching Blake, I was looking at his interest in ancient British history and mythology. And I started to read all these 17th and 18th century antiquarians and pseudo historical writers. And came to the conclusion that amongst a certain elite, including a Lincolnshire lad, William Stukeley. So Stukeley was a doctor, a cleric, a member of the church. He was a clergyman, and he was also a self-styled druid. So he's one of the first, they're called the Neo-Druids. In the 17th and 18th century, you get a number of peculiar English and Welsh gentlemen in particular who decide that actually they're druids and that there's been this constant tradition going through history.
Was there something in the water, Jason? Was there something in the water that was actually leading to this?
It was actually, to be honest, I think a lot of it was caught up with, I mean, there was a darker side to this. It was caught up with notions of imperialism. You know, Britain must be special. Britain must be exceptional. So they kind of look back into history and they see these figures called the Druids who had mystical powers and decide that they're going to recreate them. But my favorite fact, because I use the scare quotes because it's completely untrue, was that according to William Stukeley, the Greek hero Hercules, during his 12 labours, so if you read the stories of Hercules, he conducts 12 labours when he's punished by the gods. And during one of these labours, he travelled into what would become Israel, in Palestine, the Holy Land. He met Abraham, was converted to Judaism, travelled to Britain, where he built the Pillars of Hercules, which are, of course, Avebury, and thus brought the ancient religion of Judaism to the shores of Britain. William Blake lapped this up because, yeah, so, it's absolutely hilarious, but leads to these, I mean, Blake's most famous poem, Jerusalem, and Did Those Feet in Ancient Time, kind of shares in this very strange mythical history. So I'm constantly finding out weird stuff about William Blake.
I'm intrigued by the sort of line from the BBC's own sort of definition, or the short descriptor they give. Considered insane and largely disregarded by his peers, the visionary poet and engraver William Blake is now recognised among the greatest contributors to English literature and art.
Absolutely.
Graham, back to you.
Why was he not considered? Why was he not popular in his period?
This is the classic academic answering on something he knows way too much about. Blake was actually better known during his lifetime than we often realise, but he was known for other things. So Blake was trained as an engraver. I mean, that was his day job. That was his trade. And actually, during his lifetime, he was quite famous for some of his engraving work. In fact, there's a book, which I don't have to hand, but it's this huge, massive book called The Grave by a poet called Robert Blair. And Blake did the designs for that. And throughout his life in the 19th century, he was really famous for that book. So people, you know, would have this huge coffee table style book of religious poetry with Blake's engravings. And they're very well known. What he wasn't known for is what we know him for today. So things such as the poem Jerusalem, for example, and Did Those Feet in Ancient Times, only appears in two copies of his works. And he actually got rid of it at the end of his life because nobody was reading it. Poems like The Tiger, 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 Burning Bright, you know, the Songs of Innocence and of Experience that Alex referred to. These were not well known during his lifetime. And one of the main reasons was that poems such as those, which can be immensely popular, Blake's method of production, of engraving the plate, of etching the plate, writing in wax and then using copper to etch it away, and then hand painting these pictures, was incredibly laborious. His books were very, very expensive. We tend to think, you know, we tend to think of Blake as producing books, but in some respects, he's producing collections of prints. And the same way that, you know, you wouldn't today go and, I don't know, buy a Damien Hirst for a few quid, people had to spend a lot of money to get Blake's books. And that's one of the very simple reasons why they didn't sell particularly well, because they were so laborious, they were so time intensive to produce, that there were only very few copies of them in circulation. And it's only in the 20th century, the late 20th century, that you get cheap reproductions of Blake's poetry as he intended them to be read. The other reason as well is that alongside these, Blake could write very simply, very clearly. One of his famous later poems is called Auguries of Innocence, and you've almost certainly heard the opening to it, of it. To see a world in a grain of sand and heaven in a wild flower, to hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. Absolutely beautiful poetry, incredibly simple, you know, children's verse, but also profound. But alongside this, he also then had these mythological books with Orc and Urizen and Fuzon and Ahania. All these, I mean, I like to think of him in some respects, and this, I kind of, one of the reasons I have an interest in what Alex does and the science fiction stuff that he does. I think that Blake was a kind of a first science fiction author. He was a kind of a fantasy author. He was creating, inventing these heroes, inventing these names at a time when people didn't do this. So people would read his books and go, who the hell's Uthu? Who's Ahania? Who's Urizen? They just didn't understand these invented characters.
The whole mystical aspects. Sorry, Graham, carry on.
I've just got two more things to ask, otherwise I'll hog it. So I'll give them to you and then you say what you want to say about them. So firstly, I'd love you to say who then discovered him? Who brought him to life? And secondly, I like his paintings. I find his paintings, they are today. And here's this man in the Georgian times way ahead of himself, of anybody in his artwork, and it would sit really well. He's very interesting, his style of painting. What do you feel about that?
So I'll start with the last one first, actually. Yeah. So his art, I think, is astonishing. So I mentioned kind of reading The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, but also it was about that time that I first really started to get into his art. So there's two really famous pictures, which are actually quite related in their subject matter. The one is probably best known as The Ancient of Days, which shows, you know, kind of what looks like God, this naked figure with a long beard and long white flowing hair reaching out to the sun to draw the universe with a compass. It's not God. People think that this is Blake depicting God. It's not God. It's his false god, Urizen. So Blake has this very complicated mythological system. The other one, which you can see, if you ever go to the British Library, you'll see a bronze statue of representation of it, is this picture of Urizen, which again shows Urizen sitting on a rock, reaching forward and measuring an abstract diagram in front of him. And what's fascinating about that is that in one image, it looks nothing like Isaac Newton. If you've ever seen pictures of Isaac Newton, Blake's portrait of him looks nothing like the man. It's entirely a mental image. And it shows Newton as this kind of angel. Newton's like this Greek, you know, beefcake god. But also, Blake is being critical. Newton is surrounded by natural beauty, but all he can do is focus on an abstract image. That Newton has to reduce the universe to laws, to an ordered system, rather than the kind of the chaos, the complexity, the emotional drive which fills Blake's universe. So I think his art is astonishing. It's interesting. Technically, I'd say that Blake is not a very good painter. There are plenty of his contemporaries from, you know, Gainsborough, Reynolds, many, many other painters of the 18th century who are better painters. But Blake is the most astonishing artist. He has visions. He has a completely distinctive style of drawing, which is nothing like his contemporaries, which again alienates him a little bit from you know, people at the time. But in the 20th century, in the light of modernism, he was very popular with the Surrealists, for example. You know, you look at the Surrealists, you look at Max Ernst or Salvador Dali, you look at William Blake and go, yeah, I can see what's going on there.
Absolutely.
So to answer your first question then, it's actually very easy. The person who discovered him was a man called Alexander Gilchrist. Alexander Gilchrist is the first proper biographer of William Blake, who publishes a book in 1863, I think is the... So the 1863 or 1868.
Right in the middle of the American Civil War, Jason. I mean,
Yes, indeed. And actually, that becomes important for other reasons. But Alexander Gilchrist... lived around London and then in the centre of London, and starts to realise, talking to the few surviving friends of Blake who are still around in London at the time, that there was this incredible artist which everybody's forgotten. So he starts to dig out and find all his work and bring it together. And in 1863, he publishes The Life of William Blake, Picta Ignotis, The Forgotten Artist. And it's a sensation. It's a sensation because for the first time ever, he collects together a large portion of Blake's work. So people can read this and go, how did we not know this existed? But also it's a sensation because he actually, to do justice for it, he produces this incredibly beautiful book. The Gilchrist Life is a real collector's item. It's a beautiful book. And it itself becomes then really influential, first of all, on the Pre-Raphaelites. So people like Dante Gabriel Rossetti, Algernon Swinburne, etc., writers like that at the time, are really influenced by Blake's work. And then later on, it leads into the arts and crafts movement. So, you know, this notion of actually using your skills, your craft, to create beautiful objects becomes incredibly influential in the late Victorian period as a reaction to industrialization.
I still think there's a classic to be made with respect to the lamb. I mean, little lamb, who made thee? Dost thou recognise who made thee? Gave thee lifestyles and bid thee feed by the flow and all the mead. I mean, it's joyous. You know, it's what we need to help us through lockdown.
Absolutely.
Rebecca, over to you, good self. I mean, as an undergraduate who's followed through with histories of journalism, you joined the Midweek Drive team a wee while ago. You're now one of the stalwarts of that. Any thoughts or questions you'd like to raise before we start asking Gabriella how she can also promote her own podcast in the near future?
Yes.
Yes, Jason, I'd love to ask. You've talked a bit about the works that ignited your love for William Blake. Are there any particular pieces that, whether it's art or poetry, anything like that, is there a particular favourite you have in either of those categories?
Yes, I'll end. So the image-wise, probably the one that I've written the most about is Newton, the one I just mentioned. And I'll just end briefly with the poem that I gave the title to the book, which is my favourite Blake poem, called The Divine Image. To mercy, pity, peace, and love all pray in their distress, and to these virtues of delight return their thankfulness. For mercy, pity, peace, and love is God our Father dear, and mercy, pity, peace, and love is man his child and care. For mercy has a human heart, peace the human dress, love the human form divine, and peace the human dress. Then every man in every clime that prays in his distress, prays to the human form divine, love, mercy, pity, peace. And all must love the human form in heathen, Turk or Jew, where mercy, love and pity dwell, there God is dwelling too. And the reason why I like that is it shows that Blake's religion, for want of a better word, had nothing to do with dogma. It doesn't matter what you believe, who you are, what your creed is, what your colour is. If you show mercy, pity, peace and love, you are divine.
That's amazing. I love hearing it read out loud as well. It brings so much emotion to it. And you can picture him, you know, sitting there and processing all these amazing original thoughts and putting them on paper. I love it. It's amazing.
Of course, Rebecca, on a cosmological level, we are all William Blake because we're all echoing the same sort of air atmosphere and various other things. There's almost a Buddhist
there you go.
The mysticism and so on. But maybe that's for another time. Gabriella, again, you joined us recently on the Midweek Drive together with one of my other tutees, Elise Rose. You're getting together with this podcast, which is currently being edited. Share with us. And also, we promoted Jason's talk later on this evening. Why should we also get onto Spotify straight away to tune into this? The thoughts of a couple of English and journalism students at the University of Lincoln.
So a little bit about our podcast, first of all. It's called Don't Stand So Close to Me, and it's all about the things we can only relate to in a COVID world. So our first episode is on phone fear. So we've spoken to Caitlin Mensah, who's the editor of the Lincoln Tab, and she's basically been telling us how journalism students in particular are actually finding it harder now to get interviews and that type of things because they have to pick up the phone instead. And she was saying how people prefer to actually email instead of ringing up the phone. And so we've done a little a chart as well to show that we did a little survey, and it showed that 42% of 18 to 21 year olds actually don't like speaking on the phone and prefer to email.
These are the findings. This is the rationale. This is what it's all about. It's astounding. But hats off to your good self, Gabrielle, for taking this opportunity and running with it, because that's what we actually need from that point of view, which is great. Graham, any questions you'd like to put to Rebecca, Gabriella, or Rebecca or Gabriella, or indeed any other sort of subsidiary things? It's over to you, sir. As indeed we started doing these shows, Graham, what was it, 40 years ago? So long before Rebecca or Gabriella were even born, really. But what the heck?
150 years ago it was.
Yes, exactly. I remember it. I remember it well.
Well, it's really for all of you. I'll go to Rebecca first. I assume all of you, I know that Jason does, all of you have English at your heart, that something about English, the language, is really important to you to discover and study and whatever. Why? Well, not why, but when did you first discover your love of English and the studying of English? I know Jason will have a lot to say about that because that's exactly what he's studied all his life, it seems.
But did you want me to go first? Okay.
Yes.
I think it's difficult to pinpoint an exact moment. It's something I always enjoyed from a young age. I enjoyed reading. I enjoyed writing. When I was very young in, you know, year two, year three, year four, we were told to write stories and be imaginative. I was always told that I'd write too much and I should stick to the limit and you shouldn't be writing more than 6 pages like we told you to. I'd be writing 10, 12. So I always had this passion for writing and poetry, and I just did that in my spare time. As I got a bit older, I started to enter competitions. I won a few local awards around my local area, such as the Adrian Bell Society Award, which is an award given to students who progress in English really well. I've always just strived to do it for myself and just do it as an enjoyable thing because I enjoy it for my own pleasure, but also it's something I'd love to do in the future. So can't pinpoint it, just always loved it. And I chased the passion, so.
And you came to Lincoln, even answer. Better.
I did.
Gabriella.
I think the same as Rebecca, really. Well, I kind of grew, my mum is from Colombia in South America, so English wasn't actually my first language. So I've kind of been learning as I've been going along. And sort of with writing, I've just found this love for writing, particularly like, because obviously I did writing in Spanish quite a lot, and then suddenly I was writing in English and I was like, wow, look at these words and everything. But yeah,
I said that when I marked your essay, Gabriella, I think, yeah. As I recall. Wow, look at these words.
Yeah, but I've just had this sort of love for writing, really, and reading particularly as well. I'm a huge fan of Stephen King novels and works. So yeah, I think he inspired me a lot with reading and particularly writing as well.
It's really interesting because right, I'm in theatre and film and television business. Well, not film, because I haven't made a film, but that's my business. That's where
Who's Doctor Who shows are epic, Graham. We know that. We've already sorted that out, as Rebecca said when she saw Waters of Mars for the first time last week.
Yeah, thank you very much. So my whole childhood and life was not being in awe of English and loving English and, oh, I must study words and I must be the... And yes, I've ended up in a business which is all about, well, film is really, really visual, but I need words. I need... Actors need words. They need to express themselves. I seem to spend my life reading a script and saying, hang on, we need to change this because people don't talk like this. And who am I to say that? Maybe I'm wrong. So it's really weird that I've never had the passion that you three have had for English, and yet I've ended up with it being very important to me.
Just shows the mysteries and wonderments of life, particularly on the eve of what is basically the official national wine tasting day tomorrow. So just in case people are wondering in terms of how to actually cope with that, you can have a bottle of wine in Lent because it's officially national wine tasting day. Jason, we haven't even had a chance to even begin to start talking about the notion of Englishness, or indeed, as I was suggested by one of our mutual colleagues, what you were doing with a copy of Homer's Odyssey on a recent sort of meeting that was actually there. A whole range of things that, don't worry, it was perfectly legal. But we do need to fall to those last two questions. So Rebecca, as you're sort of one of the regulars as far as Midweek Drive is concerned, would you like to do the last two questions, please?
I'd love to. Jason, have you had a reasonably enjoyable Zoom with us this evening?
I have indeed. Thank you very much.
Wonderful. Graham, have you?
I have. This has been really interesting and it's gone very, very quickly.
It has, hasn't it? Gabriella, yeah. What about you?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I loved it.
Oh, great. Will you all be joining us again then?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Indeed.
We'd love definitely. To have you back.
There we are.
Super. And if you want more on William Blake, an hour's time.
I will be there.
It'll be there. Professor Jason Whittaker, of course, the principal of the whole sort of system, the head of the School of English and Journalism at the University of Lincoln, Gabriella Van Genien's awesome student based currently in the Suffolk region, Rebecca Bond, also equally wonderful in Norwich, and of course, BAFTA award winning director Graham Harper. Huge thanks. Keep on keeping on, and bye for now.
Bye. Thank you.
Help us to help you. That's the critical message of the latest Public Health England National Health Service campaign. You may have already heard some of the radio ads that have been working through the system in terms of persistent coughs and so on. But actually, to address this, we're delighted to welcome back, of course, that ace guru of Matters Medical. Of course, it's the awesomely talented Dr. Hilary Jones. Welcome once again to the Midweek Drive, Dr. Hilary.
Thank you, Alex. Lovely to be here with you.
Excellent. So let's talk us through this particular campaign, because clearly people might have noticed there has been lots of things happening with respect to public health in general, with pandemics and so on and so forth. But actually, at the heart of the National Health Service is surely this importance of being able to actually deal with things like cancers, things that are treatable. And this is really at the heart of this campaign, I suspect.
Absolutely. All the conditions that we normally see in general practice and in hospital medicine are still there. They haven't gone away simply because of this pandemic. So whilst a persistent cough at the moment, everybody focuses on, oh, could it be the virus? Persistent coughs can have a number of different causes, anything from silent reflux to allergies to inhaled allergic reactions, sinusitis, etc. The list is quite long. But amongst that list is lung cancer. And lung cancer remains the third commonest cause of cancer in England, accounting for about 39,300 new diagnoses every year. And it's imperative that something as serious as that means that people get investigated and assessed and treated as quickly as possible to give them the best chances in the future. So if you have, the message is in the Help Us Help You campaign, if you have a persistent cough for more than 3 weeks that is not COVID-19, then please contact your GP surgery, talk about your symptoms and get it assessed and sorted out.
Looking at the demographics of this, Hilary, are there any particular areas of society that are more prone to this? Is it a case of, well, if you're over 50, it's a disaster, if you're over 60? I mean, again, is it a case of that, or is it rather like cancer? It doesn't have any particular demographic. It can affect anybody at any time.
No, we can identify risk factors for lung cancer. We know that 89% of lung cancer is diagnosed in people over 60, and it's quite unusual under 40. So age is a factor. Smoking is a factor. Having said that, there are people who've never smoked and haven't been exposed to passive smoking, secondhand smoke, in other words, in the past or in their families. Who can still develop lung cancer. So age is one factor, smoking is another, some other occupations can have a bearing. But by and large, it's a condition affecting, again, people in certain socioeconomic groups who would be more prone to the habit of smoking for one reason or another. So we can identify certain people who are more at risk, but I think anybody can have a risk. So if you've got any concerns at all, persistent cough, more than 3 weeks, call your GP.
Fear, of course, is one of the kind of wonderful things or less wonderful things that really impacts people on whether they're prepared to contact their GP and actually take those first steps, etc. What advice would you actually have for people who are listening to this and think, oh, well, that's all right, but what if I go and there's something wrong and I just don't want to know? So ignorance is bliss, so I won't do anything. Any thoughts on that instance?
There are people who like to pretend that they haven't got symptoms, that they're in denial, and they may think they don't want to be a burden at the moment on the health service, seeing how busy it already is. They may feel that it'll just go away if you give it time, that they've never been poorly in the past, why should they be now? And what I would say is that they've got nothing to fear. GPs these days, you know, are not the sort of frightening frightening people that they once were many years ago. They're very...
I always used to like Dr. Finlay and Dr. Kildare. Good. I thought they were great people.
Yeah, but not Dr. Lancelot Surratt, did you? Sir Lancelot Surratt was fearsome and perhaps not all that sympathetic. But these days you will be treated with dignity and respect and sympathy and efficiency. And you help us. In helping you, if you come to us early with your symptoms and your concerns, once it's got established and it's gone beyond the lungs, then lung cancer is very difficult to treat, and the early stages have a much more successful outcome if we treat it then than waiting for people to leave it too late. So we understand that doctor surgeries can be scary for people, but they have changed. They're not the sort of clinical ether smelling places that they once were, and doctors will treat you very sympathetically. We will listen, we will get you referred. If it's priority, we'll get you referred. And what I want people to know is that we have COVID secure cancer hubs up and running. We have got extra capacity because we've employed the independent sector in recent months, and we're doing pretty well with all the normal cancer services running throughout the pandemic last year. lung cancer has fallen off a little bit in terms of referrals. We do want those people not to think they're going to be a burden, not to think that the NHS is not COVID secure. It is for people like yourselves. And please come forward, get your symptoms sorted out.
And finally, our people listening to this, where would they go to find out further information about the Help Us Help You campaign or indeed find things online?
They can go to the website and they can also go to NHS Cancer Symptoms website for further information about symptoms themselves. But of course, I think if you've got any concerns, really what we're doing is directing people to their GP. Yes, the GPs are busy. They're doing vaccinations, but they're also doing other things as well as we need to.
And from your own point of view, Hilary, I mean, I think unprecedented has been a word that's been overused over the last few months, certainly. But I mean, going through these particular times, I mean, are you coping yourself? I mean, we obviously been engaged in lots of debates with this morning and so on and so forth. But has it been a case of, well, I wouldn't change that last 12 months for the world? Or would it be a case of, well, interesting times?
Well, very interesting times. I wish it hadn't taken a pandemic to focus people's attention on health so much. Of course, professionally, it's been massively challenging and very interesting. The biggest public health threat for many, many decades, and how society reacts to it and how we manage it. You know, the psychology of the way people think about such a thing, and the anger that's engendered on both sides you know, we should have a stricter lockdown, we shouldn't have any lockdown at all. These kind of psychological battles are very interesting from a professional point of view. And personally, I've been blessed to have something to distract me from the worries of the pandemic. But we'll get through it. It'll take time. And if we're strong as a society, we'll get through it quicker than we would otherwise. And we will. We'll get there.
And it's been great news for my journalism students and my public relations students, because they've benefited in all sorts of ways. It's a whole new world. For the moment, Dr. Hilary Reynolds, huge thanks as ever. Those two final questions, you know what they are. Have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today?
Oh, very interesting indeed. Brilliant. Thank you.
And the next critical question is, will you return in the not too distant future? Will you come
back? We will be there. Yeah, absolutely. I'll be here.
It was the late Gene Roddenberry who put at the heart of his whole Star Trek philosophy the notion of infinite diversity in infinite combinations. And what was good back in the 1960s, as it was projecting ahead to the future, certainly seems to be resonating within contemporary times as well. Certainly with the recent news that the European Space Agency is also putting out a greater call for diversity. That's just one aspect which is good news. And indeed, further good news, hopefully, is going to be provided now by the awesome senior director at M3, who've just produced a wonderful report with respect to diversity and improving it. That's the fabulous Bex Rycroft. How are you, Bex?
Yeah, good, thank you. Lovely intro, thanks.
Well, I mean, Bex, in a real sense, it's taken us a wee while to get here, but that whole notion of strength with diversity is a message that probably still needs to be addressed, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, innovation is crucial for every single organisation who wants to stay ahead of their competition. And we know that more diverse tech teams and those with more wide-ranging experiences actually help to generate a lot more new ideas, and therefore will help shape those businesses and help them become more successful. So it's absolutely crucial to industry that we have diversity.
I see from the report, the headlines are 92% of businesses are planning to recruit junior tech talent in 2021, but only 40% of those are actively trying to address the lack of diversity in their tech teams. I mean, is that through prejudice? Is it through laziness? Is it a case of just inertia? Any reasons for this?
So out of the businesses that we surveyed, actually 23% of those businesses said they didn't actually know how to change, and 40% of them don't even have diversity targets in place. So I think they need to start looking at how they build more inclusive businesses and more inclusive environments to actually attract these young people.
And in general, how diverse is the technology sector? Because one used to have this impression that actually, well, it kind of, you've got real tech experts if you happen to be based in the Asian countries and so on, and then maybe Silicon Valley and so on. I mean, is it too easy for us to actually start applying stereotypes to the tech sector? Or is it actually getting more diverse by the day?
So it's been an agenda item for a really long time, as you know, but actually disappointingly, we're not much further forward. It's still only 19% of all technology roles are held by women and only 15% from an ethnic background. And then when you look specifically like UK FTSE board, only a third of those positions are held by women. And actually 63% of all FTSE companies have no ethnic minority people on their boards. So there's still a lot to do, and we need to sort of move forward to make sure that there's equality at all levels.
And are there misconceptions that women and people from different minorities might have about technical aspects that they think, oh, it's not for them because it's too complex, it's too complicated, it's not their sort of area that they want to pursue? Or is it just a case of, again, it all boils down to the education aspect?
So I think, yeah, lack of education is a real thing. And obviously schools have a really tough job at the moment, but we found that only 40% of young people are actually being encouraged to consider a career in tech by their school. But one thing that you raised, which is really good, is around the sort of perceptions and sort of barriers to entry that young people perceive. So we found that 3/4 of them don't actually think that tech careers are amongst the most future-proof. And only 32% of them felt that there was a really wide range of opportunities within technology. And some of the things you talked around about what sort of stops them going forward is 29% of those actually said they were worried about their qualifications and therefore whether they would be able to have a career in tech. And 19% of those said they didn't even think they had the right educational background. So we need to do more to break down those barriers to entry, because some of those things, you know, yes, you might need to come from a STEM background for some roles, but actually technology is so broad. It's across so many different industries that you don't necessarily need to be a maths whiz to be successful. And it's definitely not the maths that you would have done at school. So yeah, we absolutely need to do more to break down these perceptions.
Artificial intelligence is clearly emerging day by day, it would seem, in terms of how intuitive things are being developed, etc. What we're doing now is a classic example of how technology is enabling our particular work to continue via communications, interviews and so on. Is it sometimes the actual speed of change that sometimes might put people off thinking, well, I might well learn this today, but then I've got to learn something completely different tomorrow?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, technology is moving fast and it's moving forward all the time, as you've just said. And actually, we talk about the half-life of jobs and that's only 5 years. So that means every 5 years, the skills that you have are going to be half as relevant as they are today. So what that means for companies in terms of closing the skills gap is they're going to need to do more to continue to reskill and upskill their workforces. So we can't just look at, you know, talent coming in or focus on recruitment. We actually need to look at how do we continue to retain people and continue to train them within their jobs to keep them relevant. So there's actually the sort of full circle of life that we need to do to make sure that we continue to close the skills gaps.
And this report obviously focuses primarily on the United Kingdom. I mean, are there global areas that we could learn from as well? Are countries doing better than us in terms of enhancing diversity in their particular workforces?
So I think it's a global agenda, absolutely, and M3 have a US business as well, but we actually find that the trends are pretty similar, and we are going to be sanctioning a report very soon, very similar just to do in the US as well, and we work closely with colleagues in India as well with our business, and we find actually that it's very common. Places like India, you obviously have people from class as well as backgrounds, sort of rural versus cities, which is a challenge as well, but I think it is a global challenge about bringing enough young people into technology.
So folks who are listening to this, Bex, where would you point them to actually find out further details about M3 or this report, or indeed just getting involved with technology themselves?
So in terms of the report, m3.com, and then it's just /diversity report. But M3, you know, our doors are open. We're helping graduates all across the world find new careers in tech. So we're hoping to, you know, happy to talk to anyone from schools, companies, organisations or individuals. So do come through to M3.
And what drew your own career pathway to M3, to become senior director at M3, et cetera, Bex? Was it a case of, I've always been interested in technology, or was there a particular moment where you thought, actually, I quite fancy this?
Do you know what? I don't think there was a particular moment. I think I've always just been excited about the breadth of opportunity. And I'm one of those people that felt that it's a really future-proof industry. The pace of change means that they're always going to require people with skills within technology. So I think I just thought, not only is it super interesting because you can change people's lives, you know, with the technology that's there in their healthcare, all the way through to financial services, and you're helping exciting trading platforms. So I think that just the breadth of the industry is what really attracted me.
Fantastic. Well, Bex Roycroft, Senior Director at M3, huge thanks. And happy tech diversifying, Bex.
Thank you. Cheers. Thanks.
Now, clearly, we've just passed by the joys of Valentine's Day or St. Lofacolia Day and so on. And let's face it, we're heading into a situation where we need our pets more than ever these days. But tragically, animal rescue centres have been under real pressure, not only yesterday, but during the entire pandemic, because charitable donations have been dropping significantly, with many seeing a 50% fall in revenues and obviously having to deal with that accordingly. Now, to address this issue, and indeed allowing for Valentine's Day treats that they might have been taking part with, we're delighted to welcome two wonderful folks. So first of all, from Support Adoption for Pets, the wonderful Amy Angus. How are you, Amy?
I'm good, thank you, Alex. Thanks for having us.
Very good. And the Chief Executive Officer of Birmingham Dogs Home, that's the wonderful Giles Webber. How are you, Giles?
Yeah, great. Thanks, Alex.
Now, Amy, if we can come to you first, because clearly pets are so important to us from that sort of point of view. But looking at the sort of way in which adoption has occurred and rescue centres and so on, it's absolutely vital for Pets at Home to actually start supporting pet adoption, isn't it?
Absolutely. We've, you know, rescue centres have had a really difficult year with their fundraising income being significantly hit. And Support Adoption of Pets and Pets at Home have always supported rescue and rehoming organisations across the country. But Valentine's weekend for us was a really good chance for us to really share the love with these organisations around the great work they're doing. And we surprised these rescues with a £2,000 donation each on Friday morning. And then we also announced that we were going to support further with an emergency grant programme, which is available for rescues across the country to use. So we really wanted to send that message out and support the great work that our rescues do across the country.
Absolutely. Again, looking at the total, I mean, over £500,000 there, £550,000 across the country with 278 animal rescue centres. Giles, was the Birmingham Dogs Home the lucky recipient of one of these grants?
We were indeed, Alex, and Friday was a tremendous day for us. It was lovely, lovely news that Amy was able to announce, not just for us, but as you've said, 278 rescues across the UK. And £2,000 will make a huge difference to every single one of those rescue organisations.
And in terms of that, I mean, looking at the last year, I mean, clearly we've all had lots of challenges, but I mean, how has it actually been for the Birmingham Dogs Home? I mean, has it been a case of you've literally just had to keep going on a day-to-day basis, or has it been a case of, well, you've managed to cope because at least there were strategies in place?
Well, of course, it came as a complete surprise to us, like it did to everyone, in terms of actually what changes need to be made. And since last March, we've been essentially closed to the public. We look after our dogs as we have done. We are able to go about most of our normal operations. We've had to change procedures, both for the safety and welfare of the team itself, with distancing and that sort of thing. But the big thing has been that we can't do any fundraising activities. We can't meet our supporters. And that's really difficult, not just from a financial point of view, but from a social one as well. We love our supporters and they love Birmingham Dogs Home, but not being able to do any activities that have involved them has been tremendously difficult. And financially, as I think you quoted earlier, we have seen our income reduce by more than half over the course of the last year. And yet our costs remain exactly what they were before, because we want to provide that care for the dogs that are with us. So it is very, very difficult.
Yeah. Now, Amy, returning to yourself, I mean, Support Adoption for Pets is obviously the number one financial supporter of pet rescue centres in the United Kingdom. It was established by Pets at Home in 2006. and exists to give Amanda and Pets a second chance at happiness. I mean, I always think it's one of those tragedies of the human condition, certainly in Britain, when pets are abandoned. But, you know, I would have thought, again, looking long-term, tragically, people might have actually taken it, brought in a pet for lockdown, and then after lockdown say, oh, we can't cope with it anymore, and they just abandon it. I mean, that's horrendous. But presumably it's why we need an organisation like Support Adoption for Pets being in place.
Yeah, absolutely. And the big thing for us is around education. I think Giles may have mentioned it. You know, if you're thinking about getting a pet, no matter what pet that might be, either a fish, a hamster, a dog, whatever that animal is around researching, you know, everything about it, speaking to people who've got that animal, speaking to your vets, speaking to your rescues, you know, your rescues in the community are there to help and support and guide you before making that decision, because, you know, both myself and Giles are absolute animal lovers, but you have to make that decision responsibly. So, yeah, make that decision the right decision for you and your family. And, you know, I've got my dogs and absolutely love the bones of them, but you make that decision that's right for you and your family.
And Giles, £2,000 might seem quite a lot, but can you just share with us how it will actually at least make a difference in terms of your work at the Birmingham Dogs Home?
Of course. So when we got to hear the news on Friday morning, we made a decision immediately that £2,000 would go towards an operation for one of our younger dogs, Teddy. Teddy's a five-month-old bulldog puppy that came into our care last October. And he has a condition called Swimmer's syndrome, which essentially means that he struggles to walk. And that money will go towards an operation that he'll have in the coming weeks that will allow him to walk normally and have a full and enriched life. And before too long, I know he'll find his forever home. So that's a really practical example of how our decision was made so much easier on Friday by the support from Amy and her team and Support Adoption for Pets.
That's fantastic news. So, Amy, where can people go to support Adoption for Pets, and how can they locate your organisation and obviously donate as and when?
Yeah, so if you head to our website, which is www.supportadoptionforpets.co.uk, your listeners will find on there loads of information, the grant programme that's on there that I've mentioned. We've just put further funds aside to help rescues. So if you know of a rescue who needs help or you work at a rescue, absolutely pop on there and get in touch. And yeah, if you're able to donate and help your local rescue centres through this time, that would be also amazing.
Absolutely. Well, congratulations again on the fantastic work that you actually are doing. I'm saying congratulations. I just sort of great thanks for the work that you're actually doing. Just keep up the excellent material. To Amy Angus from Support Adoption for Pets, and of course, Chief Executive Officer of Birmingham Dogs Home, that's Giles Webber. Huge thanks. Keep on keeping on and be well.
Thank you. You too, Alex.
Thanks, Alex. Take care.